What is that?
An acorn.
What is this?
An acorn.
An acorn.
Yeah.
What do you think when you hear someone say acorn? Like where?
I don't know if I'd know what that was.
On this episode of the Bear Grease Podcast, we're going to get a PhD in acorns, or as some of you might say, acorns. We'll deep dive into acorn biology with renowned wildlife biologist Dr. Craig Harper, learning some fascinating stuff that every woodsman should know. And we'll explore how we use language every day to define cultural identity with Dr. Daniel Roop. We'll debunk the American myth of rugged individualism as we discuss the value in the preservation of regional culture. Put on your seatbelts, boys. This is a windy road of biology and social science as we search for the significance of acorns.
One of the things I'm most pleased with is your correct pronunciation of the acorn fruit.
Music to my ears, Dr. Harper.
My name is Clay Newcomb, and this is the Bear Grease Podcast, where we'll explore things forgotten but relevant, search for insight in unlikely places, and where we'll tell the story of Americans who lived their lives close to the land. Before you get too indoctrinated, I want you to take a second and note the way that you pronounce the word spelled A-C-O-R-N. Say it out loud and remember it. It means something. I've always been interested in acorns. I've looked for them relentlessly since I was a boy. It wasn't until I was an adult that I realized there was national tension about the way the word was pronounced. I've been in the arena, so to speak, on this debate for some time. I imagine it's kind of like being born into a war you didn't know you were fighting. And maybe you were even the one instigating it, but you didn't know why. Acorns are important. I've always felt this. We're going to discuss the puzzle piece they play in acquiring wild meat, specifically for white-tailed deer. But I think we'll find other reasons why they're important. In 2013, I cooked bear cracklings for Andrew Zimmern on his show Bizarre Foods on the Travel Channel. The episode was titled The Ozarks. Somehow, the pronunciation of acorns came up.
Our bears are acorn-fed. So when you see bear fat and you see an acorn, same stuff.
That is sweet and clean. Oh my gosh, that's those acorns.
Or acorns, as you would say.
I was trying to fit in and be one of the guys.
As I listen to this audio, I have to ask myself, why? Why do I care how someone pronounces a word? Almost a decade later, I'd find myself in the heat of incoming fire from none other than my own dear pal, Stephen Ranella of Meat Eater. In this clip put on Instagram by Steve, he's got his back to the camera with his children by his side, and they're watching a video that I made about oaks and acorns. He's pounding the table and emphatically telling his kids how to pronounce the word acorn correctly. I could only watch and gasp, as I'm certain many of you did as well.
Deer, bear, turkey's favorite. But the acorns begin to sprout immediately in the fall, which means white oak acorns last for short periods of time, but are highly valued by wildlife. Red oak acorns last
acorns.
And are less valued acorns. By wildlife. Identifying these species.
I love Clay Newcomb, but what a hillbilly.
What a hillbilly? Come on, bro. I'm trying to understand what all this means. I did a little experiment at a get-together the other day. I pulled aside three couples from different states, handed them an acorn, and asked them how they pronounced the word. I was pretty surprised at a few of their answers.
Okay, I'm going to take something out of my pocket. I'm going to show it to you, and you just tell me what you would call it, okay? So, what is that?
An acorn.
An acorn. Okay. What is this?
An acorn.
An acorn.
Yeah.
Where are you from?
South Dakota.
South Dakota. Is that normal in South Dakota to say acorn?
Mm-mm. No.
Acorn. Have you been indoctrinated by Southerners?
I have.
Now, where are you from?
South Dakota.
So you were born and raised in South Dakota.
Yep.
And like, without a doubt, acorn.
I would say acorn.
What do you think when you hear someone say acorn? Like, where?
I don't know if I'd know what that was.
Yeah, it's not going to hurt you.
Acorn. Definitely it's an acorn. Acorn, not an acorn. Acorn.
I'm not a good one for this one, Clay, because I've heard you correct people. And I deliberately try to say acorn now.
Do you really?
Yeah.
What would you have said before, though, Jeff?
I think I would have said acorn.
Acorn.
No, what would you really? Said, I think I was. It would have been like a blend of one or the other.
So tell us where you're from, Casey.
Oh, I grew up in Louisiana, deep south.
So you would say acorn, though.
Acorn. And
from New Orleans, Louisiana.
Yes, sir, because it is A-C... O-R-N, correct?
That's right. Yeah.
Acorn, because that's what we call that town.
Yeah, well, where are you from, Jeff?
Yeah, Southwest Arkansas.
It's an acorn.
Say it again.
An acorn.
How would you say it?
Acorn.
Really, you'd say acorn. Now, where were you from? Where'd you grow up?
That would be New York, acorn.
Where did you grow up?
Florida, but St. Petersburg, which was a lot of Ohio and Michigan.
What do you think when you hear somebody say acorn?
I think they're from the South.
Really?
Absolutely.
Do you think this is like a hillbilly?
No, I just think they're from the South.
No, that's South. They said it in North Carolina, they'd say acre.
Acre.
I'm still trying to understand what all this means. Sharon McCrum is a New York Times bestselling author from Southern Appalachia. She has a knack for celebrating the history and folklore of the Southern Highlands in her writing. Like me, she's particular about the pronunciation of words, specifically the word Appalachian, and she considers it a non-negotiable. In this clip, she gives the reason why semantics are important and how they tell a bigger story. But first, take note of the way that you pronounce the word spelled A-P-P-A-L-A-C-H-I-A-N.
The safest way to say it is Appalachia. And I have to explain this to people because when I go off on book tours, I find myself being appointed as cultural ambassador. And I will get somewhere west of the Mississippi and people will say Appalachia. I will correct them and they will say, well, that's how we say it around here. So I finally had to come up with a story to explain to them why it's not optional. If you're in Ireland, in the north of Ireland, and you start out in Donegal, that city on the west coast, and you're headed for Belfast, it will take you most of a day to get all the way across Ireland, and you'll be driving on the coast road, where if it's a clear day, you look off to your left, you'll see Scotland in the distance. Well, about halfway between Donegal and Belfast, there's a walled city, which is hundreds of years old. It was built by the Irish, and they named it the Irish word for oak tree, which is dairy. But a few hundred years ago, the British conquered Ireland, and they changed the name of that town to Londonderry. So it is one town with two names. And so if you stop at a little store along the way and ask directions on how to get to the walled city, you can walk in and tell the man behind the counter that you want to go to Derry or you want to go to Londonderry. And either way, he will tell you how to get there. But you need to know that when you choose what you're going to call that city, you have told that man whether or not he can trust you. You have told him your politics, your religion, which side you're on, and how open he can be with you in one word. Because Derry is what the Irish call it, and Londonderry means you sympathize with the British rule. Appalachia and Appalachia work exactly the same way. Appalachia is the pronunciation of condescension, the pronunciation of the imperialists, the pronunciation of people who do not want to be associated with the place. And Appalachia means that you are on the side that we trust.
In Sharon's example, we see the transfer of information in an accent. And in many cases in history, that personal info has carried with it high stakes. Jeff Shreve is a podcaster, biblical scholar, author, and longtime friend of mine. In the book of Judges in the Bible, accents were used to determine the region of the country that soldiers were from during a regional war, and life and death were in the balance. For context, the word we're going to use, Shibboleth, was the name of a river crossing. Or maybe it's Sibboleth. Jeff Shreve, I am trying to understand how language is used and has been used in the past to define people groups and culture, specifically for my word that I'm dissecting here, acorn. But I know in the Bible there's a story that very clearly shows that this has been going on for a long time,
right?
Using pronunciation of words and accents to identify people. Tell me that story in Judges.
Yeah, so there's, I think it's Judges chapter 12, and there's this, he was really kind of like a warlord type of guy. His name was Jephthah, and he was kind of an outcast in the land. He had his own band of ruffians that he roamed the land with. The tribes were being oppressed by this other nation, which is what we would call them today, the Ammonites. And so the tribe, they reached out to Jephthah and his band of merry men, I guess, and asked for his assistance. He went out, conquered the Ammonites, and everything was good. Well, then a neighboring tribe, they were known as the Ephraimites, they were upset with Jephthah. They were upset that this battle had taken place without them. And the Ephraimites,
they just wanted to be a part.
Well, they go to Jephthah and they said, hey, you should have called us. And he said, hey, I did. You never showed up. We had to go and take care of business. And so there's this battle that breaks out. They say, well, you need to leave the land. And he's like, I'm not leaving the land. I'm staying right here. I deserve to be here now. And so this battle breaks out between the Ephraimites and Jephthah's people. Jephthah and his people take the river. They take control of the river that separates the Ephraimites' land from the Gileadites' land. And so the Ephraimites can't get back. And he starts really whooping the Ephraimites. Like, they want to get back. They want to get back home. And so they start fleeing, and they would come to the places where you could cross the river. And Jephthah's people would go, are you an Ephraimite or are you a Gileadite? One of our people or one of their people? And they would say, oh, I'm a Gileadite. And
assumably, they look the same.
Yeah, they all look the same.
This is the same nation of people.
They're all Hebrew people.
So they would dress the same for the most part.
They just have different ancestors within the Hebrews.
Same,
yeah.
Except for,
they have a little bit of a dialectical difference in the way that they speak. And so they would come to the river and they realized, hey, some of these guys are escaping because they're just lying and saying that they're not Ephraimites.
Right.
And so they said, here's what we'll do. We're just going to set up a test. When we ask them, if they say, yeah, I'm a Gileadite, let me cross the river, say, okay, say Shibboleth. Now, the Ephraimites, they didn't say that. Evidently, they didn't say that sh sound right on the word Shibboleth. They said Sibboleth instead of Shibboleth. And so when they would say it, it was kind of, I always imagine like Daffy Duck trying to say it. It's like Thibboleth. They couldn't quite get it out right. And so they wouldn't say it like the Ephraimites did. And that's how they would know. And they'd kill them right there.
Wow.
There was just
high
this
stakes,
distinction.
Man.
Exactly. And that's going on throughout history. Like, there's always these Shibboleths is what it's been called ever since then. In World War II.
So this has been used throughout history as a metaphor.
It's used right now. It's used in towns. You know, it's used in warfare. It's used in culture. It's used everywhere. In World War II, the Allies, when they would capture German spies, frequently the Germans had been trained how to speak English. And they would know how to about the culture and the customs of the Allies, about the American Allies. They would know about baseball. They would know, I think there's even a Twilight Zone episode about one of these captures of the Nazi people or Nazi spies. But they were trained in British English instead of American English. And so there were little words that they would say that would give them away. And so frequently they would catch a Nazi spy. He would be speaking real clear English. He would talk about the Brooklyn Dodgers. He would say all of the right words. And they would say, okay, let's hop in that vehicle over there. And they said, okay, I'm hopping in the lorry. Well, the lorry is what the British would call a truck. And so there's the giveaway right there. There's the Shibboleth. And they know this is a Nazi spy.
What does the pronunciation difference mean? It's not a hard word to say. A-C-O-R-N. I've found myself deeply planted on the non-traditional, or at least phonetically speaking, pronunciation of the word. I've learned that the southeastern United States, roughly 20% of the country geographically, pronounces the word the way I do. The other 80% pronounces it phonetically. There is certainly something bigger at work here, and it might have broader implications. After some research, here's what I learned. Basically, the acorn pronunciation is a throwback to Old English. It's a combination of Low German, whose word for acorn is ecker, spelled E-C-K-E-R. And the Dutch word is a combination of these, and the Dutch word for acorn, which is acker, spelled A-K-E-R. By the 1500s, the English still had an urn on the end, and that urn still holds strong in much of the southern United States. This is the audio from a YouTube video titled A Quick Lesson on Southern Linguistics. It's on a channel simply called Rob M. It's a very interesting clip about accents in the southern United States.
Most people don't realize that the American southern accent is not a sign of ignorance, but actually the fact that, according to linguists, we're the only people left in the United States who generally still sound like our ancestors. Because if you listen to native-born southern speakers, the average southerner tends to sound more like this, what we call this moonlight magnolia's drawl, because if you speed up that southern drawl, over time it rapidly becomes a British accent. Most people don't realize that people that came here from Europe were largely from the United Kingdom. So when they got here, this was more along the lines of their speaking tones. But that's the first and second generations coming off the boats, not their children. By the third and fourth generations, the kids don't quite sound like mum and dad anymore because they're starting to develop a slight elongation of the way they talk. What's today called? The Virginia Tidewater accent. It's not a complete southern drawl because that's a port area. But as you go farther into the southern interior and the years progress, the accent tends to get thicker, deeper, richer by Arkansas, Alabama, Georgia. Heck yeah, you got a full-blown southern drawl. But people don't realize that in most cases in Louisiana, many of the native speakers don't sound like that. They tend to sound like this, I guarantee, spelled around the bayou. Because you speed up that South Louisiana Cajun Creole accent, over time it becomes en français, French. With, of course, certain exceptions in New Orleans, which tend to sound like more like New Yorkers because of the Irish and the Sicilian Italian influence. So they tend to sound a bit more like this. And people tend to get a little confused because they think, what, you're from New York? Nah, I'm from New Orleans. Why? So you have to realize that at the end of the day, Southern speakers, like I said, we're not ignorant as it's often been assumed, but we simply sound like the ancestors that came here so many years ago.
This is my mother, Judy. We call her Juju. She has a master's degree in teaching and retired last year after being involved in public schools for over 40 years. She has a professional connection with the word spelled A-C-O-R-N. Maybe this gives some insight into why I'm so worked up about it all.
Juju, where you at? Here, I've got something here.
I used to have them.
I'm getting mud on your floor, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Okay, what is that?
An acorn.
It's an acorn?
Uh-huh.
Where do you work, or where did you work your whole career?
I worked at Acorn Schools for 32 years. 32 years. It's a consolidated school.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever in your life heard anybody call it Acorn School?
Not anybody associated with the school. With a close-knit association with
the
school.
So, like, the principal, the...
Oh, no.
Acorn.
Acorn. We go to Acorn Elementary. We are the Acorn Tigers, and it's the best school in Arkansas.
People who are connected to the land can become obsessed with natural cycles. For me, a time of celebration is when the acorns start to fall. Typically, I'll commemorate the first white oak I find on the ground by putting it in my pocket. I just like to stare at it when nobody's around. Sometimes I keep them in my drawer here in my office. That might seem strange for many reasons, because I don't eat acorns, but they're highly symbolic. My dad was like an obsessed drill sergeant when it came to finding them. I mean, he still is. I spent the formative years of my life searching for acorns, and I still search for them relentlessly. Here's my old dad, Gary Newcomb, the Black Panther man himself. We're sitting on the front porch in a rainstorm.
So, when I was a kid, we didn't hunt deer. We hunted acorns. We weren't looking for deer. We were looking for acorns first and then deer sign. Tell me what acorns mean to Gary Newcomb.
Well, no one...
You can tell us a little backstory about it.
You know, no one in my family deer hunted. I didn't know anything about deer hunting, and two really intelligent guys, principal of a school and a guy that just had like 160 IQ, had a coffee shop, and they deer hunted. And I'd go to their coffee shop, and they talked about deer hunting, and I got caught up in it. And they would take me hunting. They showed me how to shoot a recurve bow, but they couldn't kill deer. And I related it to playing chess. There's got to be a way to get on these deer. And one day, we were down in South Arkansas, and a guy was at our camp, and he said, deer's favorite food is white oak acorns. And if you have, it was weird. Turkey hunting was real hard for me to learn. A lot of stuff's real hard for me to learn. But when I heard that, I thought, if I'm hunting humans, I'm going to hunt at McDonald's. And I'm not going to hunt at a McDonald's unless it's got a lot of trash on the ground, a bunch of cars. I mean, there's got to be some activity. You know, I don't want to go to a McDonald's where there's not very many people going. I'm going, this has to be how to kill them. And keep in mind, I don't even hardly know what a deer track looks like. So as soon as he tells me, I come back to my hunting turf, and I said, I'm not leaving here until I find white oak acorns dropping. And I had enough insight into it to where he didn't tell me this, but I thought, there's got to be deer droppings there. Yeah. I'm not going to hunt unless there's deer droppings. And so I found two big white oak trees, and I killed more deer knowing nothing about deer hunting. And all of my buddies who were raised
killed up... Killed them with a bow.
Yeah, and I mean, it's like...
In a time when very few people were doing it consistently.
Yeah, and I mean, I missed a couple of pretty good bucks, too. But the first morning I set up, I remember going home and telling my mother this. Now, I was a grown man. I didn't live at home, but I went to her house for breakfast or something. And I said, Mother, you won't believe what happened. I found this white oak acorn tree with droppings under it. I put my ladder up a day ahead of time, and I sat in it this morning. And I had 11 deer coming in no more than groups of two. It was just like a movement. They were coming from my left to my right, and they'd stop.
It was like the most exciting thing you'd ever found. And you found the ticket. Do you have any kind of, like, emotional high when you find a big old green white oak acorn on the ground in October?
I love it, man. I mean, I love it. It's the first, it just tells me the time is right. It's killing time.
It seems honorable to me that if anybody's going to be particular about the pronunciation of any word, that same feller ought to have some deep knowledge of it, or he might as well be indifferent. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to get a PhD in acorns. We're going to nerd out on acorn biology with one of the country's foremost wildlife habitat experts, Dr. Craig Harper of the University of Tennessee. He's about as tall as an average 2A high school point guard, and he's built like a bobcat. He's got a warm smile and overflows with hospitality. His ability to functionalize and communicate about the natural world is unusually adept. And by the looks of the turkey beards and big racked whitetails that adorn the walls of his house, he is a veteran hunter.
This is a deep dive into some of the most interesting stuff about acorns that I've ever learned. If you get lost in this nerd out, please stick around for the last section of the podcast with anthropologist Dr. Daniel Roop. It's fascinating. But I'll warn you, this talk about acorns with Dr. Harper will likely change your life too.
Meet Dr. Craig Harper.
Pretend like I don't know anything and walk me through the life cycle of an oak tree in the different species.
They flower in the spring. There are two different groups, of course. of oak species. You have the red oak group and the white oak group. There's a couple of real distinguishing characteristics between those. The easiest and most recognized is that the lobes of the leaves of red oaks have bristle tips, and those of the white oak group do not. They have
so they're more pointed. Rounded. So a red oak has a pointed lobe, and a tree in the white oaks family has
And not just a pointed lobe, but it actually has a bristle tip. The more important points of those two groups is that, of course, the species within the red oak group, their acorns require 2 years to develop. So they will flower in the spring, and what will become the acorn begins to form, and it grows through the summertime, but then it doesn't mature until the following summer and then drops the second fall. Red oak species thus then can have two acorn crops on it at any one time. You know, okay. the tree doesn't produce 1 year, and then 2 years later it might produce again. It can produce each year because it will have flowers and the acorn set and then mature acorns.
But it takes 2 years to make an individual acorn mature.
In general terms, the species within the red oak group, those acorns have higher tannin contents, which is a phenolic compound that causes an astringent or bitter taste. They will not germinate until springtime. The acorns of red oak species are important into the following spring and even sometimes into the summer.
So what you're saying is that a red oak acorn is going to fall in the fall, and let's just say it falls in late October.
And lay there all winter long.
It's going to lay there all winter long, and it's not going to sprout, and it's not going to rot.
Most of them will not rot, and wildlife will eat those acorns at that time through the fall and winter. But if white oak acorns and acorns of different species have different tannin content, if those that are less astringent are available, you certainly may see various wildlife species select those. And thus, those that were more astringent may lay longer.
Right.
But the point is, those acorns are available for a longer period than the white oak acorns.
Yeah.
And the white oak acorns, they fall in the fall. Most of the acorn fall of the white oak species, Quercus alba, is in October. But nonetheless, all of those of the white oak group, they will germinate in the fall and winter. And
pretty much immediately.
Very few, if any of them, are available into the following spring. They fall, and it's not that long until they begin to germinate and try to start, you know, sending down a little rootlet.
Yeah. I want to tell you a story. Last week, I killed a raccoon over my hounds. I cut his stomach open full of acorns. I mean, they're still in red oak acorns.
Yeah.
I mean, they are still eating very good red oak acorns in March.
And they are extremely digestible. Acorns, regardless whether they're eaten in the fall, winter, or spring, are highly digestible. And with a very high fat content, which actually increases the digestible energy that is available from acorns as opposed to many other foods. Another characteristic that distinguishes the red oak acorns from the white oak acorns, or another factor, is that the red oak acorns typically have much higher fat content than the white oak acorns.
Mm. So as hunters, at least me and my dad are always trying to figure out what the mass crop's going to look like before it actually happens. So, and I've been anecdotally studying this for 20 years, you know, just kind of keeping track of the last frost and when I saw oak tassels. So I'll be driving down the road, and yesterday I noticed oak tassels hanging off trees. Is there a way to make even a reasonable guess about mast crop based upon all the weather variations of the spring? Essentially, we're talking about pollination of flowers that ultimately turn into acorns. And if there's not successful pollination, or if that flower dies before it's pollinated, there's no acorn. So there's got to be this successful thing that happens that's got to be impacted by rain, temperature, wind.
It's very complicated, and to my knowledge, it is not highly predictable. There's a number of studies that have looked at all of the different environmental conditions that might influence acorn production and successful flowering and acorn setting. But I remember reading in one paper where it was somewhat predictable based on the number of frost in April.
Okay.
But there's no hard number. Oh, if we have three or, you know, whatever the case
we
may
need to
be.
Come up with some kind of folklore anecdotal thing with some bear grease.
And another influential factor might have been rainfall the previous summer. So there's lots of things going on that we really don't understand fully.
Because what we see is a pretty dramatic. Like you would, if you didn't know anything about natural systems or oaks, you just think that's an oak tree, it's going to produce every year, which we know is not the case at all. And on a landscape level, there's these vast differences from year to year. You know, some years there's very few of a certain species, or there's no acorns at all.
That's right.
And then other years, it's a bumper crop.
And it'll vary along a certain slope gradient. You know, up higher, there may be acorns, but once you get down low or vice versa, you know, you just don't know how the weather variables affected the oak trees on a given slope on a mountain. Yeah, I remember when I was doing turkey research in the mountains in North Carolina, at the top of the mountains, they were about 5,500 feet. The oaks up there, every year, they would be flowering the first week of June.
Wow. Wow.
Which, you know, obviously much, much later than down slope.
Yeah. So you're going to have years where there's only going to be acorns that made on the top of the mountains, years where there's only acorns that made lower on the mountains. And usually it's not quite that distinct, but, you know, as hunters, we're looking for trends inside of natural systems.
One thing we found in the research we did looking at mass production here in East Tennessee, and others have found this too, is that among white oaks, you're looking at about two good mass crops 2 years out of five. About 2 years out of five, you expect good mass crops. And of most of the red oak species, you're looking at a good mass crop 1 year out of three or four years or so. It's a little less frequent than with the white oak group.
I love it when we find places where still in 2021 we don't really have all the answers. I mean, it's such a complex system, and I'm talking about like predicting math. Yeah, I love it when somebody like you says that, Dr. Harper, because you get this sense inside of 2021 with everything that we see and with the kind of the frequency that's emitted, that just like the world is discovered, but it's really not. I mean, there's so much that we don't know, we don't understand. And I mean, the natural systems are so complex, it just blows your mind. And just the fact that we could pick something that seems so insignificant, an acorn, and we could dive just a few steps past the surface and realize that there's things that we don't even know about them.
Yeah, you used a word that I believe is accurate when you're talking about nature and natural systems, and that's amazing. I find that that is a way overused word these days, that people just, oh, that's amazing. Well, no, it's not. It most of the time, it's not even hardly interesting, but it's certainly not amazing. Amazing. But when you start talking about nature and natural systems and how all of nature fits together, that is amazing.
Yeah.
Dr. Harper did a research project where he and his students collected acorns under the same trees for 10 years and tried various methods to increase acorn production. The study was in-depth and enlightening.
Acorns is one of those foods that certainly can influence the nutritional status of individual animals, as well as influence the populations of some species on a year-to-year basis, and even groups of years, you know, it trends over, you know, like the course of 3 to 5 years or so. Something that we work to try and help people understand is that that doesn't necessarily have to be the case.
Right.
And, you know, for example, with regard to deer or with bears, immediately people think, oh gosh, you know, we got to protect those oaks, you know, we don't want to be cutting down our acorn trees. You know, that's what the deer, you know, they got to have. Well, it's interesting when you discover that, you know, for example, among the white oaks, only 30% of the trees produce 75% of the acorns.
Hmm.
If you do the math, and this isn't my opinion, this is just math, you literally could cut down in a solid oak stand half of the oak trees and increase the acorn production by releasing the crowns of those individual trees that are the good producers. We looked at ways to potentially increase the acorn production. One was by releasing the crowns of the oak trees by cutting down or killing the surrounding trees that were inhibiting additional sunlight to come into the crown of that oak tree. And another was fertilization, because, you know, you read in, you know, all the hunting magazines, of course, you know,
fertilize your oak trees.
Your oaks, and not only do you increase the acorn production, you know, it makes them sweeter too. Did you know that? But anyway, we did this for a number of years.
Which is not true. That's where you're going with that part.
It didn't happen. But allowing additional sunlight to the crown did, and in two ways, and it was really, really interesting. Number one, once the crown is released, we found that on average, that crown would increase in size by about 25% in 1 year. That's significant right there. But also, after releasing those trees on a per square meter basis, those trees increase their acorn production by 67%.
Wow.
The other thing with regard to deer or bears, as I mentioned, as well as many other species, is if you're killing those competitors, what you're also allowing to come into the stand, of course, is sunlight. And then you have the increase in the understory. But where I'm going with this is that if you manage your woods in that way, you're not going to see those differences in health of individuals or fluctuations in populations, because deer don't have to have acorns. It's nice when they're there. But the goal should be to manage your woods, your property, such that they don't have to have acorns. In order to have enough digestible energy during the fall, winter, to make it through in good health.
So what you're saying is that oaks aren't nearly as important for wildlife as we've once, maybe as much as we gave them cultural value. And I think it's because we, most deer hunters, well, even most people that are hunting any kind of wildlife, whether you're a squirrel hunter or a bear hunter, you're interacting with that animal, for the most part, during one small sector of that animal's year.
That's exactly right.
So, I mean,
right.
Like, I'm trying to kill a white-tailed deer in October and November.
And you're looking at what they're eating in mid-October as opposed to what they're eating first.
Gary Newcomb said, go find white oak acorns and you'll kill a deer. But what you're saying...
And there's a lot of truth to that.
They'll eat them.
I've been under the assumption that acorns were the superfood of the eastern deciduous forest. I asked Dr. Harper how important they actually are for wildlife.
Dr. Harper, I have for a long time said that the white oak acorn is the chicken nugget of the eastern deciduous forest. Okay? My kids, if they walked into a room and there was like a variety of food on the table and one of those was chicken nuggets, three out of four of the kids would go to the chicken nuggets before just about anything. So white oak acorns, when they're on the ground, are this highly selected food source for lots of game, for turkeys and deer and bears and squirrels and everything. I've never heard anybody talk about the actual caloric content and nutrient value of, it doesn't have to be white oak acorn necessarily, but just an acorn in general.
In general, on average, the kilocalories, there's about 3.5 to 3.6 kilocalories per gram. And that's very high. And the total digestible nutrients in acorns is very high. That is higher than corn. That's higher than soybeans. That's higher than herbaceous forage. That's higher than the woody browse. So it is a nugget. I don't know if I'd call it a chicken nugget.
So you're telling me I'm right in my
analogy? I would
choose
some other things other than chicken nugget. But you're exactly right. It's a highly prized, it's highly palatable with regard to its taste, especially the white oaks. It's highly digestible. And again, the very important thing is the fat content. And that's what really helps increase the digestible energy in the acorns.
Okay, 3.6 calories per gram. How can you just guess how many grams would be in a average size white oak acorn as big as the end of your thumb?
If you did the math, about 8 calories per acorn.
Is that all? I believe it. It's just
and that's of a white oak acorn.
So
only,
like
meat
eight,
only.
8 calories per acorn.
That's correct. An interesting thing is that the pounds produced is not that much. And I did a little calculation on this. I thought you might ask some of that. What we found in a good year is that there would be, you know, around 80 acorns per square meter
on, okay.
you know, that have fallen in a good year. Well, we weighed all of these acorns. And of white oak acorns, about 200 acorns are required to reach a pound. And if you only count the acorn meat, then it would be just over 300 acorns required to realize a pound. When you look at the average crown size of white oaks, in a good year, a white oak tree, on average, produced about 47 pounds of acorns or 29 pounds of acorn meat.
Mm. Would an acorn be considered a nut?
Well, technically it is an acorn, but we colloquially call it a nut.
Is a nut a biologically descriptive term of a fruit?
A type of fruit, yes.
So an acorn is technically not a nut.
That's correct. And it's not an acorn. One of the things I'm most pleased with is your correct pronunciation of the acorn fruit.
Music to my ears, Dr. Harper. Music to my ears.
You don't know how many places I go, especially when I'm up in Wisconsin and Michigan, and, you know, I love those folks up there. We poke fun at each other, of course, but, you know, every time I'm up there and we're talking about deer and habitat management, you know, acorn, what's an acorn? Y'all come on down here and we'll show you what an acorn is.
And we'll show you how to kill a deer, too.
I want to get down to brass tacks about the pronunciation of words, or at least bigger tacks than we've already established. Why do people say things the way they do? We need an expert. Dr. Daniel Roop has a PhD in intercultural studies and teaches cultural anthropology to undergrad and graduate students. Just for a bit of street cred, the man speaks fluent Mandarin Chinese and has lived overseas for 12 years. And he's a bow hunter.
Dr. Roop. I love calling you Dr. Roop because me and you are longtime buddies. And so I've never called you Dr. Roop in my life.
Finally, I'm getting the respect that I deserve.
But you have, I know for sure, that you have some insight into this question that I do not have. And what I'm trying to understand is, why are we so particular about the way that we say certain words? There's this thing that's pretty deep inside of me about certain pronunciation of words. No one told me to be particular about those. So what does that tell me about myself?
Well,
about our society?
Sure. So I think it's a really normal part of the human experience. Everyone essentially at like a primal level is insecure. And so we're told, you know, certainly as like Western Americans, postmodern people, that you're an individual and you exist apart from everybody else. But really, in some ways, you're an individual, but none of us exist apart from a social group. Mm. And the stronger and more solidly defined that social group is, deep down, the more you can take a deep breath. And so we do all sorts of things, all sorts of behaviors, material culture, things we wear. Think about like, if you want to establish a really clear group boundary, when you're in high school, you wanted to have the right brand tennis shoes or pants or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And that's the whole reason why our culture has fads. Every, you know, 5 or 10 years, we recycle another fad. It's because everybody wants to fit in, not necessarily with like the popular crowd or whatever crowd it is, but certainly as adults, we want a clearly defined social identity. And identity doesn't exist apart from a group. So acorn, this kind of topic is one more tool that people use to...
So we use language in a really strong way to define what social group we're a part of.
Constantly. We invent... Language and culture continually changes, and we invent new words and languages all the time. And one of the main reasons we do so is we're trying to create, maintain, and establish a secure identity. Yeah.
So what does it tell you when somebody's really particular about something? They're highly insecure?
Well, I wasn't going to bring this up, but I do think you're very insecure. No, I think a lot of times, I remember, so my wife, you know, is from Michigan. And so 20 years ago when we got married, I went up there to visit her family. One of the first things my father-in-law did was literally take me next door and introduce me to their neighbors and say something, Daniel, because he just wanted them to hear my accent.
The way you spoke was a novelty to them.
Yeah. So, and I think of course it can be very negative, but it can also just be very fun and very innocent and really a fun way of doing and establishing culture and language.
But as we are establishing this cultural identity and establishing the groups that we're a part of, there's got to be some advantage to that. I mean, like going back mm-hmm. deep into human history, if me and you were the same
mm-hmm.
and you knew I was the same as you, and by same, I mean we just had this background or some connection point.
Sure.
Like, there's a higher probability that you would help me survive. I mean, that's the whole point of like social groups. Is that about right?
So if you think about like people and, you know, thousands of years of people, they're pastoralists, they're semi-nomadic, they're agrarian, they're farming, and you have close-knit extended kinship groups of people who are doing the same practical activities every day, day in and out, all year long. But they are using literally the same lingo to make sure they survive. So we're all talking the same talk means safety and security, provision,
just inside
sustenance.
Of communication.
Just inside like, of communication. Exactly.
You might say a corn, and I don't understand what you're saying.
Yeah, and essentially, so this is where kind of the switch flips. When you start talking about fundamental needs and somebody is different and uses different lingo, they look different, they act different, they smell different, you know, whatever it is, the switch starts to flip and the question becomes, can I trust this person at a deep level? So the gentleman who really kind of is a seminal author on this topic of group-held identity, a Polish sociologist of the 20th century, Henry Tajfej. So he was a Jew in Poland, obviously at a time when he was in a group that was despised. Mm-hmm. So he really looked at this and wrote about it, and almost every author, anthropologist, sociologist who interacts with it is going to talk about him. And so he certainly sees it from a negative view. And a lot of times humans really use it in a very broken, destructive way. So acorn, not necessarily that loaded of a topic, but
it's
still
about
the same
trust
mechanism.
Trust and distrust.
Totally. It's totally about trust and distrust.
Do you recognize this inside of your life? Do you see, because I deeply identify with that. Now, I mean, if somebody says acorn, like I can hardly even say it. I don't inherently distrust
sure.
them, but when I do hear someone say acorn,
mm-hmm.
it's really strange. Like, if I take a step back from myself and try to have this unbiased look, it's like I feel a connection to that person.
Sure.
Like, yeah, when you say that it's an issue of trust, like I kind of get that. Do you recognize that in your life?
I think maybe not. I'm not as insecure as you are. So I think maybe, no, definitely. Definitely. I think everybody does, because socially every day we are operating on what is called scripts. And so you kind of have a script of expected ways for conversations to go. And
right.
when you bump into somebody and they follow in general your social script expectations, you take a deep breath. When they step out of bounds, but it causes you to a little bit of a pause. And no matter how small, you don't realize it, but cognitively you're constantly checking social scripts. Do people fit my expectations? Do they not? And almost all the time, difference is not seen as a neutral thing or maybe even an interesting thing to be explored, but it's seen as a negative thing.
The other thing that I'm trying to understand is, where is this healthy and where is it unhealthy? Because, you know, like in this playful in this playful word that we're talking about here, acorn and acorn, describe to me in like two concrete blocks, when is it positive and when is it negative?
So we've already described when it's positive. So we're using creative aspects of culture, things we wear, ways that we talk, behaviors that we have, that we do, And as a group with these certain people, I do these things together and we form a healthy social identity. So I don't feel alone in the world. You know, that's healthy. That's good. It's normal. It's natural.
We're and we should keep social creatures.
We're social creatures inherently. It becomes negative when, in order for me to establish and maintain a salient or solid social identity with others, I need to tear down or oppress the social identity of another. If I make identity by saying Akron, great. And I can say that all day long and kind of the behaviors and other linguistic patterns that go along with that, fantastic. But if I need to like dually construct identity by saying Akron and then saying that people that say Acorn are idiots, and you extrapolate that over behaviors, nationalities, you know, whatever it is, places you're from, any number. I mean, humans do this all the time. We make identity in it in a healthy way, but also in a broken way.
So what is tribalism and how does it fit into language?
So tribalism would be groups of people, in a sense, they're bounded. There's a clear boundary around this certain social group. And so every individual exists in the center of concentric circles. Mm-hmm. And you keep going out. It's like me, and there's my immediate kind of nuclear family. There's maybe the people at my workplace, the people in my hometown, my nation. It just kind of keeps going out. A tribe or tribalism is somewhere I decide to draw a hard boundary. One of those concentric circles becomes my tribe. And we are out for us. And everyone else is out for themselves or potentially against us. Mm. And so tribalism becomes problematic because essentially...
Is tribalism always negative?
No. It's not. It is certainly not always negative.
Because in today's society, it's often used as a negative term.
It certainly has... The contemporary use of the word tribalism or the idea of tribalism essentially is weaponized identity.
Mm.
So some other group outside of me is going to try to force their identity on me, or they're going to demean our tribe's identity, or I'm going to do the same to them. That would be like the contemporary idea of
but
tribalism.
But the concept of tribalism would be like very native to human nature.
That's
how we exist.
We all need a tribe. We can't exist by ourselves. We just right. can't do it. So COVID-19 happens. Everybody's in lockdown and like mental health plummets. Suicide rates quadruple because we're isolated from our tribes.
Yeah, so I guess I'm trying to understand where the boundaries are for being positive and negative. Because, for instance, Dan, like, excuse me, Dr. Roop.
Thank you. Thank you.
You know, I enjoy living in the southern United States.
Yeah.
Like, it's my home.
Heck yeah.
It's all I know.
Yeah.
I like it. I feel like that's healthy. But at the same time, I see examples from anywhere where that becomes so much a part of someone's identity that it becomes almost weaponized.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not cool.
Mm-mm.
And I feel like I can be a southerner. I could be a northerner. I could be from wherever.
Sure.
And like have this love of the culture where you live.
Yeah.
And that be healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Because you... And I feel like it stems in, like, respect for your own culture means to me that you respect someone else's culture.
Yeah.
Because, like, your wife from Michigan, like, very different culture from Arkansas, she loves it up there. Her family loves it. They've been there forever.
I don't understand it. They're really strange. They talk through their noses. You know, I think so. Like, there's a place and a posture and a way of living in which I'm certainly comfortable celebrating my own social identity, my tribe. But I don't need to denigrate another group in order to make that happen. If you look at society and human history really only in the last century, which is a whisper of time in the whole scope of humanity,
right?
Have people been readily exposed to other groups, other tribes, so to speak, constantly? I mean, we are more interconnected.
Just technology,
globalization. But I mean, even you don't even have to go globalization, technology. Think about the interstate system in the U.S.
Right.
I mean, things that really just in a fraction of a second in human history have connected people unlike ever before.
Yeah.
Whereas for centuries before that, you had
thousands
of years before that. Sure. I'm thinking English in terms of the English language.
Right.
You've got centuries of the English language and people existing in certain topographical regions. And they would almost never encounter somebody else unless they were tradesmen or they're at war. Mm. And that was really the only other time. And in those times, there was expected differences. Of course we're going to be different, but otherwise we are in our own little world, in our own little tribe, and every day we play with and create our language. Like you've got, let's say you've got a real good buddy and you hang out with this person a whole lot, or even like in your marriage, you and your wife, your marriage starts to have its kind of own culture and your own way of talking, and your family has inside right. jokes. We do this all the time. Well, then you do that on a social level for centuries with the English language, wow. and people are isolated from other groups.
And it becomes even more defined.
And then within like a few decades, you build interstates, trains, planes, the internet. And all of a sudden, we're talking to people from all over all the time. And we're exposed to differences on a level that we've never been before.
So the world is being mixed up way more than it's ever been before.
Sure. And what happens to insecure tribes is that makes them really uncomfortable. And so we tend to shut that down in one of two ways. We entrench ourselves, or again, we leave and kind of deny our own familial identificational group.
How can we be balanced inside of this?
That is one of the many human problems.
Yeah.
I think it takes a whole lot of self-awareness, and I think it takes a whole lot of being comfortable with your own insecurities and just realizing that that mechanism is at work.
So I guess what you're saying is you're just kind of throwing in the towel with saying acorn. You're just kind of okay with that?
Well, I mean, it's not spelled A-C. There's an O in there. To me, this whole acorn kind of debate is proof that we're not rugged individualists. And that really is kind of an American myth that we love, and there's lots of great things about it, but we kind of like that we are self-made man, you know, yeah. kind of pull myself up by my bootstraps, did it myself kind of a thing. But the fact that we would argue about things like this or use language, different aspects of culture to find and make a social identity, a home, proves that we're not rugged individualists.
We're really affected by...
We need community. We need people. We need relationships. And we need them to be healthy. And the more unhealthy our social relationships are, the more upset we're going to get about things like acorns and acorns.
Even this idea of rugged individualism, which would have the idea that it's like this solo person, that is a cultural group.
Yes.
I mean, like, there's a whole bunch of rugged individualists.
When we say we are individualists or we are self-made men, I mean, you're always locating yourself in a group.
So there's just as many self-made men as there are the group that values, that overtly and purposefully values connection and community.
Yep.
So it's kind of a semantics deal.
It is,
because
a little...
the rugged mountain man needed the mountain man rendezvous. he needed more mountain men. Dan, Dr. Roop, the first whitetail buck you ever killed, what was he doing on that flat? In the Ozark Mountains.
He walked up. He's about...
What was he eating?
One of these. Right here in my
hand.
An
acorn.
It's a small acorn. That was the biggest mistake he ever made.
I'm being serious when I say that the exploration of this topic was a genuine learning experience for me, and I gained new insight into myself. That's the good thing about being a hillbilly. I'm okay with not knowing, and perhaps that's the key to really knowing anything at all. I continue to be amazed at the things that drive us that are unperceived and not understood. I think what I want to say is that culture is amazing, it's fun, and it adds context to our lives, and we really can't exist without the structure of culture around us in some way. But it shouldn't be the most important definer of our lives. I love being from the place that I am. I have an unusually strong sense of place. But if I say acorns or acorn, that doesn't fully define me. Human life is bigger and more profound than the elementary definers of this planet. perhaps there is another podcast being built as we speak, exploring the culture behind pronouncing the word as acorn. My goodness, 80% of the country says it that way. Here's my take home. An appreciation of our own culture allows us to appreciate and value other cultures, and I think that's significant. But I also believe there is great value in the preservation of individual culture. I would imagine as long as there is spring and fall, and the oaks flower, and acorns grow and come to maturity and fall to the ground, and as long as we can hunt white-tailed deer with bows and arrows and guns, me and mine will be searching for acorns. We're putting everything we've got into these Bear Grease podcast episodes. If you've enjoyed them, I ask you to leave us a review and share this podcast with a friend. I really appreciate the support.